please.
Okay, thank you. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. One shouldn't start with an apology, and I won't. I'll just say that this is mainly about neutral evolution, but it's going to be of interest, I think, I hope, for some of you, because it shows how recombination can sometimes, or linkage disequilibrium can be an independent, you know, from patterns of mutation generally, microscope that can tell us about how a population evolved. So, what I want to talk about, it's a particular question, namely, it's a question of how do patterns of genetic variation and patterns of linkage disequilibrium, how do they evolve in populations that have been subjected to a sequence, for example, of founder events or bottlenecks? So the question I must address is, how do such population size fluctuations or extreme events, where in instances of the history of the population, say, went down to a very small number, how do they affect a single and two locus genetic variation? That's the question. And so why is this even a question if I'm considering basically neutral variation? Well, it's because the standard models for genetic variation often assume a constant population size, and one needs to ask, how are the predictions modified if the population size is not constant? And so then a well-known recipe is to say, if the population size fluctuates, let's just average over it. And it turns out that in many cases, an harmonic average is the right thing to do, and allows one to describe patterns of variation also in populations where the size fluctuates. So what I'll show today is that this can, under some instances, if you look at two locus statistics, it can really fail dramatically. And so I'll end with a problem. Right, I'll give you two examples. So this is an example of genetic variation in a species of snails which lives off the coast of Bohuslän, where I come from in Sweden. And what you see here is are the genetic types at five different loci of a mother, two copies, because there are two copies of a chromosome, and of her children. And so my colleagues asked the question, if this is the mother and these are her children, and the children are carried under the shell of the snail, so people know that these, in fact, are the children of that particular mother, my colleagues asked the question, how many fathers does a mother must she have mated with to be consistent with this pattern of genetic variation? And the answer is, in this particular case, at least 17. And so that's, for the biologists, very simple, climb on top of each other. It's complicated for them. So the question is, why do they do it? And the particular question my colleague said was, is it perhaps to do with the fact that these snails live in a very fragmented environment? They live on small rock patches outside the coast. And so, you know, how are these small patches populated? Once in a while, one mother snail with her children will migrate to another island. And so then, my colleagues argued, it might be a big advantage if a snail had children from several different fathers, because that allows the population to maintain genetic variation further out, as far from the coast. So the first task then was to study, how does the genetic variation in this population, how does it change as you go further and further out. And one expects, of course, that the populations will get more and more similar the further you get out. But the question is, how much more similar? And how does it depend, for example, on the degree of multiple mating in the population? So this is a question with a varying population size, because you say that you have a certain population size on the mainland, and then one snail or a few snails move to an island, population quickly grows, and then after some time you get another bottleneck where a small number of snails moves yet to another island and so forth. Example number one. And the example number one are single nucleotide polymorphism patterns in the human genome. So I'll just explain that briefly for those who are not familiar with it. So if you take a stretch of DNA, essentially a long word out of an alphabet with four letters ACTG, and you put a line stretches coming from different randomly picked individuals, humans, then in certain places the individuals may differ in the letter. So for example here, these two individuals have a G and this the upper two have a T. That's called a single nucleotide polymorphism. And if you put sequences of two randomly picked humans next to each other, then about every, roughly speaking, one letter in 1,000 will be different. And so now the question is, if you look at these patterns globally, what can you learn about the human evolution? And in order to learn something about human evolution, one has to first make a model, which will involve certain parameters, like, for example, recombination with a certain rate or mutations happening with a certain rate. And then the question, by comparing the prediction of the model with the data, is what can we learn about these parameters? Okay, and the standard model is the Wright-Fisher model. Essentially what it says is that genetic evolution proceeds by a random copy and a paste process from generation to generation. So it's drawn here schematically. You list all the chromosomes in a certain generation, and then you obtain the chromosomes in the next generation just by randomly sampling with replacement, and that corresponds to Mendelian inheritance. Now, the other assumptions that the Fisher-Wright model makes is that you have discrete generations, so to speak, all individuals have their children at the same time. Another assumption the Wright-Fisher model makes is that population size is constant, doesn't change. And finally, it is assumed that the population has no structure, so that any individual can mate with any other individual. So this is the standard model, I would say, for neutral evolution. Now, so I've drawn here, for example, in red, if you randomly picked now, at this time, three individuals, a sample genealogy. So following back the genealogical lines, we come to the most recent common ancestor of these three individuals. And an important question is, as you know, how far in time, how many generations do we find this most recent common ancestor? Because that will tell us something about genetic variation. If, as you assume in a selectively neutral situation, the mutations rain on randomly on this tree, and I've indicated the mutations by green dots, then you would say the following. Since these three individuals all come from that one, these three chromosomes, they must be the same, because they are just copied, except this particular one, because here a mutation happened. So you could either look at the tree and see how the lines of genetic descent, how they go, or you can look at the patterns of genetic variation. Now today you'll see these two individuals are similar, and this one is different. Now, there is an important statement to make about this model, namely, if you take the limit of large population sizes, there is a very large but still finite, a very simple description of this process. In particular, there is a scheme that allows one to generate sample genealogies, the red ones, without actually tracing out the whole population. So there's a means of constructing these sample genealogies with the correct statistical weights. Correct means in this case precisely those with precisely the weight of the Fisher-Wright model, by going backwards in time without considering the whole evolution. And that's the coalescent process. And I just want to briefly go through it. So the coalescent process, first considered by Kingman, is a process of constructing these genealogies. And so it's constructed, the principle is very simple. It goes as follows. You ask, well, if I pick three different individuals here, what's the probability that they are still different in the next generation? Well, in this example, obviously, two aren't. And then you ask, what's the probability that they are still different in the generation before that? What's the probability that they are still different in the generation before that? And so on. And so you can actually compute the probability that the n individuals you start out with are different t generations back. And then if you multiply that with the probability that something happens, you have the probability distribution to the next, people refer to it as a coalescent event, to the next merger. And so that allows one to just, yes?
Yeah, why didn't you indicate two more with red lines? I mean, there seem to be...
Yeah, so I just wanted to, so what was done in this way, the evolution was generated in the model, yep. Then I randomly picked three individuals, and I traced back their lines until they met. Okay, so I won't go through the calculation, I'll just tell you that if you estimate the probability like I described, you find that the time to the next coalescent event, if I go back in time, it's exponentially distributed. And so a way to create these sample genealogies is simply, you take your sample, you randomly pick two individuals like these two, and then you draw an exponentially distributed time. That's the time to the next coalescent event. Then you have four lines, and so you continue. And so that already allows one to make important conclusions about patterns of genetic variation. For example, it allows one immediately to check whether a given, genealogy is consistent or not with the mutual hypothesis. And the point is that the time to the next coalescent event is exponentially distributed with this inverse rate. So J is the number of lines at each step. So down here, when I start at the present time, J equals N equals 5. At the next, it's 4, and so on. So you see that the average time to the next coalescent event, it's inversely proportional to the number of lines. So the trees typically look like this. The leaves are short, and then as further you come to the root, the branches get longer and longer. So now if I were to scatter randomly mutations on this tree, they would typically land somewhere here, or somewhere here, or somewhere here. They would not, with a high probability, land here. So this means that in a neutral sample, in a sample that has such a genealogy, I'll just finish the sentence, it's very unlikely to find singletons. If you have many chromosomes, it's very unlikely to find a SNP that only one individual has.
I understand what you're just saying, but on the other hand, there is 20 of the short lines. and there's only two or three long lines, right?
Right, okay. Yes, so one has to be, I just said this very vaguely, one has to be quantitative, and we heard it this morning. One way of making a quantitative estimate is to compute, for example, Tajima's D. You know, which precisely answers this question. It answers how do the probability land on one of the many short lines correspond with the compared to the probability with landing on one of the longer lines. And so I always forget how it goes, but you know, you in Tajima's D you compare the probability of having a mutation on two branches. So just when you take any subset of two individuals here to having a mutation in the whole tree. And you weight them in such a way and subtract them so that when you compute these two averages and subtract them, that for a neutral theory it comes out zero. But then when you have another genealogy where, for example, a selective sweep happened recently, these leaves will be longer and Tajima's D comes out negative. Another interesting aspect is that the time to the most recent common ancestor is proportional to the population size. Now let's imagine that the population size varies slowly as a function of time. So then, this is indicated here. you see that when the population size, now, of course, this formula was derived assuming that it's constant. Now, let me just assume it varies slowly so that this still works. Then you know, when this n is small, that is, when the population is in a bottleneck, the time will be short when n is small. So coalescence will go quickly. I've tried to indicate this here, that when the population size is large, it takes more time. When the population size is small, it goes very rapidly. That, of course, changes the statistics of genetic variation. And so people have argued that maybe, despite the fact that the population size changes, you can still describe it by the usual coalescent picture by averaging over the population size. Now, an arithmetic average would not be the right thing to do. So this is indicated by this extreme example. I've tried to just depict the population size by the width of the blue box. So here in the past, the population goes through a bottleneck. Now imagine there was only one individual here. Then all individuals must come from that. And so, and however short but extreme bottleneck will have a very, very strong influence on the genetic variation. And so therefore, it's clear that if you think of, if you try to describe the population with a fluctuating size by one with a constant size, which is some kind of average, it must be an average that very clearly feels the bottleneck. And one such average is a harmonic one, which you see the integral blows up. So when the population size just at one time point becomes very small, the n effective is very small, which corresponds to fast coalescence. Now, people have asked the question in recent years, how good a description is that? Under which circumstances does this really hold? So what's nice is it's actually possible to compute the statistics of the trees exactly, given any population size dependence. And that's what we have done. And I'll briefly show you the result. So, of course, first we have to decide what observable do we want to look at. And what we decided to look at was the sum of all branch lengths of the tree. Because that corresponds, if you assume that the mutations rain on at a constant rate, to the total number of polymorphisms in the sample. So what we compute then is the distribution of the number of polymorphisms in a population which is subject to repeated bottlenecks, for example. And so, as a physicist, the first question, the first observation was, this can only work either if the population size fluctuations are very fast, faster than typically the times between the coalescent events, or very slow. And so what we did is we took a sinusoid, we took a branching process with a sinusoidally varying carrying capacity with a certain frequency, and computed the distribution of the number of SNPs or total times. And that's shown here. So this is for a small frequency, and this is for a large frequency. This is a very slowly varying population, and I've plotted the histogram obtained by doing many realizations of the coalescent process, the histogram of the total time. And it's compared, that's red, to the coalescent prediction, and it works, of course, extremely well, because the population size is almost constant. Now, down here, it's a very rapid population size variation, and it also works very well, but slightly rescaled, and the rescaling is just due to the fact that because of the varying carrying capacity, the effective population size doesn't equal the maximum population size or the arithmetic average. But in between, anything can happen. And now, if you want to interpret empirical data, one must determine confidence intervals, and you see that there are distributions of all kinds of different shapes, which one has to know in order to make reliable estimates. So our aim was to compute these. And just one more sentence, and so you see that for fast populations, if the population size varies quickly, the coalescent works. If it varies slowly, the coalescent works. In between, it doesn't work, yes?
You didn't actually use the carrying capacity to change sign, did you?
It changes sinusoidally around a given mean.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. So the dashed line is the change in carrying capacity. The lines is the actual population number coming from this branching process model. And then we just followed back genealogies by picking a random sample and going back in time. And so it turns out that these very fast fluctuations, because they don't have a large amplitude, they don't make any difference. And so what's shown here, for example, are the moments of the
Yes. One more question. The rescaling, I mean, also works when the variation is rapid, but then you don't just use the effective population size.
Yes, we do. So when it's very rapid,
the population size doesn't depend on whether the variation is fast or slow, right? It's always the same.
Sure, because you know when you calculate the average, it depends on how long stretches of time it's.
There's no time scale in the calculation of the effective population size.
Well, so I mean you have to compare. So there are two time scales which you have to compare, and they are the time scales. So you know the trouble is what happens if you get a coalescent event before the population size has gone down rapidly. You know, so. Then it would more like look like, for example, genetic variation in an expanding or declining population. So you always have the two time scales, time to the next coalescent event, and whenever I speak of the frequency of the population size variations, it's always with respect to, or say the time, the period, with respect to the time to the next coalescent event. And there's actually maybe a problem with that, and that's the following, that the time to the next coalescent event isn't well defined. Because I showed to you that at first the coalescent goes very rapidly, and then later, when there are fewer lines, it goes slower and slower. So this means...
The point that you're actually not varying the population size, but you're varying the carrying capacity, so the population size somehow has to respond to that, is that...
So you can see, however, here, how the population size responds to the carrying capacity. That is the comparison between the dashed and the full line.
Okay. But this is true for slow variations or for in any case?
So that depends on the particular model used. So here what we used was exponential growth with rate R and a time-dependent carrying capacity, which we chose quite large. And the growth rate was also chosen quite large because we wanted the population to rapidly adapt. Okay, now, if that's not the case, if you, for example, were to choose a much slower growth rate, then the population would have more difficulties catching up. And then we wouldn't have this, say, artificial separation of timescales between the black fast wiggles and the slow dashed line. But then we could still do the computation as we've done, but we would have to do it conditional on the actual black curve, which is very laborious and doesn't allow for any analytical calculations, so we didn't want to do that. Yes?
One slide back. So these red curves, what are the actual expressions for this red
exponential
curve? Exponential.
Or geometrical distribution. So it's the distribution.
I
don't know. So why do you wonder?
I just want to know what's the shape and why would I? Can I somehow
see why?
Is this this way or some other way?
Yeah. So for example, so let's just talk about the simplest case. Let's talk about the a distribution of the time to the most recent common ancestor for a sample of size 2. So then you start out with 2 individuals, you draw an exponentially distributed number, and that's the number to the next coalescent event. So you know that in a sample of size 2, the time to the to the most recent common ancestor is exponentially distributed. Okay, so now you do the same, but you have a sum over all times, and you know that... I don't know.
It's a convolution of multiple.
That's what it is, precisely, yes.
Okay.
Yes?
So in your a priori harmonic uniform,
yes.
Wouldn't you expect actually some like decay factor that for a very long time back, doesn't matter what the population size was, and that decay factor itself depends on the history?
Yeah, sure. So, in fact, this is related to what I was saying to Joachim. So what you're saying, let me rephrase it, and then you say whether I've rephrased it correctly. So the difficulty is that whenever I talk about time scale of a population size variation, let me just assume that it varies on the same time scale throughout the past, I have to compare that to some other time scale, and I've argued that the relevant one is the one to the next coalescent event. Now, however, initially the coalescent goes very quickly. So initially, all population size variations are slow within reason. But when I go very far back in time, the times between the coalescent events become further and further apart, and I could imagine that compared to that long time scale, my population size variation must be fast. So then you might think that you could describe this whole picture by 2 numbers. One number describes what happens far in the past. It'll be some kind of effective population size that should work, because the times are so far apart, compared to them, the population wiggles quickly. But initially, it might not work. So, you know, initially, it might look more like an expansion or a decline. And that corresponds, as you know, just to lengthening or shortening all the branches by the same amount. And so you might think that you need 2 parameters to describe the distribution, the lengthening and the shortening and the effective population size. And for not too fast variations, it actually works, and this is what this is. Okay, but the main, so and this is another example So this is a population size that just randomly varies between two values with certain rates, and the lower, so let's say usually the population is n, and the lower is x times n. Now, what I wanted to talk about in the second part is how is the two local statistics, what about linkage equilibrium in populations that are subjected to such repeated bottlenecks? And okay, so now, as I was following these talks, I was thinking that if you make experiments on bacterial evolution and you have them in a petri dish, and then every now and then you take them and put them into another petri dish, that's exactly what happens. And so now my question is, how does this sequence of founder effect, or the sequence of strong bottlenecks, how does that influence linkage disequilibrium? So that's the next and second and last topic. Okay, so in the first part of the talk, I talked about such genealogies. Let me briefly repeat. 1, 2, 3 stand for three different individuals, or chromosomes rather, and here are given the sequences, and I follow their lines of ancestry back until I reach the most recent common ancestor. And then if there were no mutations, all individuals would have to be the same. But now mutations happen. And so they, in a neutral case, rain randomly onto the graph, and they give rise to patterns of genetic variation. And that's what I discussed in the first part. Now, you might wonder, if 1, 2, and 3 each represent a chromosome, if you look at different places on the chromosome, do those places, according to this model, they would all have to have the same genealogy. But in practice, we know they don't, and that's a consequence of recombination. Namely that, in the process of reproduction, an individual inherits part of a chromosome from the mother and part of a chromosome from the father. So that means, if you go back in time, that the genealogies of the two parts of the chromosome are likely, very likely, to be different, because the father and the mother have different genealogies. So that's indicated here in blue and red. So blue and red correspond to different places on the chromosome. And so as you go back in time, suddenly here a recombination event occurs, which is represented as two lines splitting because the genealogies differ. And so now you have to follow both loci, both places, back to their respective most recent common ancestors. And you saw that I've drawn the most recent common ancestor for the red ones, it's here, and the one for the blue ones is here. So what does it mean? It means that the time to the most recent common ancestor, it will change as you go along the chromosome when a recombination event happens. And as you very well know, as Maynard Smith has pointed out long ago, this means if you have a system with many, many mutations, so many mutations per recombination length, per IBD segment length, then you can directly see these branches in the patterns of variation. Because if you have a stretch that's very old, for which the time to the most recent common ancestor is very far back in time, if you assume that the mutations reign on a given rate, there will be many. And then a recombination event happens. You maybe go to a branch, to a bit that has a very short time to the most recent common ancestor. Then there will not have been so much time for mutations to reign on, and the patterns will be empty. And you can see that directly if you put the chromosomes next to each other. Now, in humans, unfortunately, one can't. Why not? Because the typical distance between mutations is roughly of the same order as the length of the IBD segments, so that is to say the mutations don't resolve these patterns. But one can really think, let me draw a picture. So one can think of, if this is coordinate along a chromosome, and let's say I look at two individuals, and this is the time to the most recent common ancestor, and let's say the recombination events happened here and here, then at one point you have a certain time to the most recent common ancestor, and all the letters, all the loci in here must have the same time because there's no cut. Then the time changes, then it changes again. So you can think of this time as a random process along the chromosome. And now, if I drop polymorphisms with a certain rate, same rate, so I assume now that the rate is constant as I go along the chromosome, which we know it isn't, so that will make complications. But then if I assume it's the same rate, there will be lots of polymorphisms here, only some here and slightly more here. So you see that the number of SNPs per kilobase pair, it varies randomly along the chromosome just as a consequence of recombination. So what people have done in the latest SNP analysis is they've calculated the correlation function of this process. And so it's a decaying correlation function, and let me see, here it is. It's not precisely the same measure. So what I've just explained is the covariance of gene histories of total time to the most recent common ancestor. Some time ago, a formula was derived in terms of the recombination rate between the two loci I'm looking at. Now, if you assume that the recombination cuts rain on equally distributed in space, then R is proportional to distance. So here's the experimental data. It doesn't fit this curve very well. But what you can see at least is it decays, as you expect for a random process. And what you also see is, so this is from this paper, that it decays differently with different rates depending on whether you have a Native African or Native American population. And so the American population, it turns out, decays much, much, much more quickly here than the African population. They also start at different levels. So a hypothesis is that this difference in decay rates, it's due to the fact that the population history is different. So if you assume that humans came out of East Africa 200,000 years ago, then you assume that they colonized the world by repeated founder events, by a sequence of bottlenecks, then it's clear that the American populations will have been subject to many more bottlenecks than the Africans. So the question is, how do such repeated bottlenecks, how do they influence the decay of linkage disequilibrium? Now that's the same question as I asked in the first half of the talk, but now for two loci instead of one. And the answer, it's here. So here what's shown are simulations of such decays for a model with a number of bottlenecks. And what you see in all cases, the correlations decay. Now here, these are comparatively weak bottlenecks. And I've shown the average over the realizations by a red curve, and it's very well described by a dashed curve, which is basically the following. It's this curve, but instead of R, which is recombination rate between the ends of the chromosome times the population size, I take an ineffective here. The old ineffective I had in the first part. You know, because this is relatively fast population size variation, so the effective population size approximation should work well. And you see it works really very well, but then it starts to fail. Now, what's the reason for the failure? This is a case where the population, effective population size approximation works almost exactly for single locus properties. Why does it fail if I look at these linkages equilibrium curves? Well, it fails because recombination introduces a new timescale. What's the timescale? Roughly 1 over r. Now, if I make r very large, that timescale becomes very small. And so, my population size fluctuation timescales are no longer the smallest timescales of the system, and the approximation must fail. But the failure, you know, it's hardly significant. In this particular case, which is a sequence of weak bottlenecks. Now here, you have a weakness, a sequence of strong bottlenecks. And so first you see that different realizations. So all this, each curve here corresponds to a particular realization of the population size curve. So you see there are huge fluctuations, but also you see that almost each individual curve, and certainly the mean, is much, 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 much higher than the effective population size approximation. So it means that in a population that was subject to strong bottlenecks, these correlations are significantly enhanced. Well, that's not so surprising, because in the extreme case, when I go back in time and first hit a very strong bottleneck, then the probability is that almost all coalescent events will happen in that bottleneck. So the time to the most recent common ancestor is just the time to the bottleneck. And that's going to be the same independent of where on the chromosome I am. Very strong correlations. So why does it decay at all? Well, it decays when the recombination rate becomes so large that there's recombination within the bottleneck. Okay, so now, so conclusion, if you have a population that in its history has undergone a sequence of strong bottlenecks or repeated founder events, you expect that linkage, that the decay of the covariance of times is much slower. It means that linkage disequilibrium is much higher, decays more slowly. Okay, so now let's compare this again to the data. And so what we should ask is, which of the curves decays more rapidly? And so then you see that, well, it's of course a question on which length scale you look at, but you know, over a large range of scales we see that the American curve decays in fact more strongly, yet from a higher level. But it decays more strongly than the African curve. So that's in direct contradiction to what I've just said. So note that one has to distinguish. So one has to distinguish a number of questions here. Question number one, at which level does it start? So this is completely irrelevant for what I'm talking about. You know, I didn't talk about where this started. I computed how much more slowly it decays. So when you look at these curves, don't look at where they start. Just look at, given the starting point, how fast do they decay? The empirical data are in direct contradiction to what I've just explained. And what I've explained isn't, you know, you can calculate this exactly, but that's not really the point. I've explained to you what the idea behind it is. The idea is, if you have a strong bottleneck, you're very likely that most of the lines in the sample coalesce in the bottleneck. So the time to the most recent common ancestor is the time to the bottleneck. It's going to be the same, almost, throughout the chromosome. So you expect that the correlations shouldn't decay at all. But in fact, in the real data, they do. So that's a major calamity. That's what I wanted to talk about. Thank you. Yes.
So the axis intercept carries very important information about the demography too, right?
Say it again.
For the curves on the left-hand side, where
you here
start from,
so
the value should be related to the variance in the coalescence time.
Exactly. And so it's very, so you wonder how did they normalize these curves?
Probably by the mean of the coalescence time square.
Yeah, okay, so that actually gives already a hint about what could be going wrong. Okay, I can say what I think it is, but I'm not sure. So people actually, so the people here filtered the data. So they had 200 individuals, I think. So you know these, they looked at the SNPs and counted them and computed the correlations. But they threw out all the markers where all the singletons. I'll say it in other words: they threw out all the markers where you had a SNP only in one or two individuals, and all the other 198 were the same. And why is that done? Because that particular measure of linkage equilibrium, it's very, very sensitive. It's very sensitive to changes in small frequencies. Or in other words, very sensitive to changes in frequencies that are very close to one or to zero. So therefore, people throw out these small frequencies. You know, in order to make to reduce the noise. Now, what does that do? So I argued that how quickly this decays, it really reflects how star-shaped the genealogies are. If the bottleneck is very strong, then you get all the lines like a brush, like a star, and they will coalesce at the same time in the bottleneck. That's the slow decay. Now, those are precisely the genealogies which give rise to singletons, because you have long legs, long leaves. So by throwing out the singletons, you throw out the information about how the linkage disequilibrium decays. And then you can also check how it modifies the single locus properties. But if you wish, a point of my talk is this, that this gives you a new axis, even when you study bacteria, for example. So you can study the single locus genetic variation. But if you study patterns of linkage equilibrium, it gives you more information. And in this particular case, as Oscar was pointing out, the single locus properties are encoded in the interception with the x-axis. And one can study, and it has been studied, how this bias changes the interception values. But the other independent part of this graph is how quickly do things decay? How quickly does linkage disequilibrium decay? And that's another independent check. And so what we are now going to do is we will mimic this ascertainment bias, and then we'll ask whether these curves are consistent with how we think human populations evolved. How are we going to do that? People have studied how human migration patterns are consistent with how genetic single locus genetic variation varies. And so we'll just take exactly the same demographies, which people have fitted to the single locus properties, and we'll check whether they fit this decay. But that hasn't been done yet. Yes?
So if the tests are very sensitive to individual, sort of very small level changes, so changes in a small number of individuals in the population, is it then the case that it requires a large number of sequences?
So,
when you, I don't know, as I understand it, next generation sequencing tends to be sort of 99% accurate. So if you've got one SNP called in one individual out of 200, then there's the question of, is it an error in the sequencing as much as whether it's a genuine representation? And if you can't discriminate on that level, you'd then need a large number of
Yeah, I think I, let me, so I want to, maybe I wasn't sufficiently precise when I said, when I explained why people throw out the synchrotron. So let me, so if you've got two loci, and you've gotten, say, type A at one locus, you take the frequency of it, and the frequency, and then say at locus B, at locus Y you have type B. So now, if you have lots of recombination between A and B, then the frequencies, they should be just the product of observing A and observing B. So that's what's tested for. Now you have to normalize this somehow. So it's, so one way of normalizing is you normalize by FA x times 1 minus FA x and FB of y, sorry, times 1 minus FB of y. So that's a standard measure of linkage disequilibrium called R squared, and it depends on the distance between the loci A and Y. So if they, if lots of recombination is in between, this is approximately that linkage equilibrium. If there are few cuts, well then these will be very different, and so this normalization gives one a certain interception here with the axis. Now the sensitivity is here. So if you've got 200 individuals in your sample, and 199 have one kind and the other one, so then this is 1 over 200. And so therefore, people have cut out any polymorphism where fewer than X individuals, and I don't know what X is in this figure, but one could look it up, have a certain polymorphism. Now, you would get, so how would one what would one have to do to improve the situation? Look at larger samples, not longer stretches. Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have, so this is another question is, how is this then related to the covariance of gene histories? So that I could, I haven't explained. Yes?
Yes, correct. That the issue with this plot is that we should have Africa on the top, right?
No. This, so this is it.
We're
so
pulling slower, if not in the top.
That's right. Yes.
So, but that assumes that there were no any kind of bottlenecks in Africa as well, right? And if I look at this, I see Mozambique, which is an island. Is it reasonable to?
Okay, so you know I'm somewhat on thin ice here, but let me just say, so there have been recently a number of studies, and this is a study using SNPs where people have asked, how does the single locus genetic variation within a subpopulation vary as a function of distance from Africa? So then people have said, well, the variation should be smaller the further you're away from Africa, because you needed many repeated founder events to get to where you are. And so people have made all kinds of different spatially resolved models, or more caricatures, trying to fit the experimentally observed decrease in genetic variation with distance from Africa with demographic models. People have even said, let's just assume that we don't fix the location where humans come from. And let's ask, which location is most consistent with the observed patterns? And people again see that somewhere out of East Africa is consistent, at least, or cannot be rejected. So the question now is, we take exactly those demographic patterns without any fit and compute the curves. And then it's an independent check of the hypothesis, which I think needs to be done. And it's got nothing to do with the question of how high the intercept is.
just have one simple question, but like at the intercept, it looks like the African populations have a very steep slope indeed, so they do have, I mean, because you were saying overall over the entire length of that graph.
Yes, I was a bit vague on that. So, and the reason is that my colleague Anders Eriksson has started to study how a given level of this throwing away of this bias affects different parts of the curves, and it's very complicated, and I can't give you a simple rule for it. So it's precisely the kind of filtering of data you don't want to do, because it interferes most strongly with what you're actually looking at, namely these repeated bottlenecks. So this is another project in itself, to ask how does the filtering affect each step of each different part of the curve. Now, that question has been answered by McLean for a constant population size. But it's of particular interest when the population size varies, because there, throwing away interacts very strongly with the actual effect. So my main message is, there are two independent pieces of information in this plot, and it's always the case. There's the interception, which is the single locus properties, and then you can make an independent check by asking how fast do things decay, and I think it should be done. So now you might so if you look at these evolution experiment in bacterial colonies, of course you have the selection, which very strongly again interacts with these effects, and I don't know how.
Okay, so do we have any more questions?